You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, four companies are chosen to build prototypes for Donald Trump's border wall. Is this thing ever actually going to happen? My guests, Marco Sippi, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Chris Lord will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the increasing automation of clothing manufacture as a Chinese company plans to unleash an army of robots in Arkansas, the reasons for a dismal summer for American cinemas, and your boss emails you on holiday. Where are you on the spectrum between replying promptly and hurling your phone into the ocean? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's features editor, Chris Lord, Marcus Hippie, the host of Monocle 24's The Menu, and our associate producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Welcome all. Let us start with the United States and an exciting new development in the progress of US President Donald Trump's cherished wall along the border with Mexico. While this wall is clearly never actually going to be built or anything, someone at US Customs and Border Protection clearly thinks it's worth humoring the president, and so four companies have been commissioned to build prototypes. Types, approximately 9 meters long and 9 meters tall. I assume I'm not alone in thinking of the napkin scene in This Is Spinal Tap at this point. But Chris, first of all, these tenders are going to cost $500,000 a go. Is there any way that this isn't a massive waste of $2 million? This thing's not going to happen, is it?
Well, okay, let's just assume that it is, first of all. I mean,
go on then.
Let's imagine that the wall actually gets built. So let's put $2 million straight up just for the tenders. Then we're going to start talking about the construction. Then we're going to talk about everything else that comes into it. What amazes me about this announcement, first of all, is that it comes in the wake while the fourth most populous city in the US is underwater. While there's lots of talk about what are we going to do about reforming healthcare, we've got, you know, endless things that they should be putting the money to. And yet it amazes me that he's still going ahead with this and still even, you know, it's such a PR thing as well at the same time. But I think what strikes as well is, you know, he talks about the idea of making it solar powered to pay for itself and so on. But whenever you build a wall, actually what you're doing is one day having something that will inevitably be ripped down one day. You know, we live in a world where time is constantly changing. If you think of every major wall, eventually is ripped down. And that's what I find very concerning here, just in the posturing of it ever happening, how useless the whole concept is. Because first of all, you know, you're not only are you throwing money into that, but you're building this edifice of antagonism towards another country that by the very fact of time is one day going to be pulled down. And so therefore, you know, it is absolutely a waste of time and money.
Fernando, how is this seen from South America? This is where we are inviting you to speak on behalf of an entire continent, and it's obviously much variegated and diverse peoples therein. But, I mean, it does seem a bit weird that... It seems weird that he wants to do it and weird that anybody really cares. I mean, bits of the border are already fortified for all the difference that appears to actually make to anything. Is South America taking this personally?
Well, absolutely. And I think the whole South America will be together with Mexico because it's quite idiotic, you know, for Trump to try to become enemies with one of their main economic allies of the U.S., which is the United States, which has a fairly, you know, moderate government. We're not talking here about Venezuela. I would understand if he would be like a political unstable country. But what's the problem of Mexico? Cool, they have some problems sometimes with illegal immigration, but I don't think the problem is that big that they should build this wall. I think Trump is doing bad PR. But as you say, I'm hoping that this wall will never be built, and suddenly we are in 2020 when we have new elections.
I mean, Marcus, this may be, you know, confirmation bias of my own being projected onto this, but I keep detecting a bit of a pattern emerging with Trump's grandiose pronouncements, in much the same way that, you know, he declared on Twitter that transgender soldiers would not be permitted to serve in the military, and since then nobody's really seemed all that interested in actually doing anything about that. where this is concerned, we're told that the prototypes will be delivered in the coming months, which could mean anything, followed by at least 2 months of testing. It doesn't sound like anyone's really in that much of a hurry, does it?
No, not at all. I guess the thing is, I was just thinking that President Trump has been in the office for over 7 months now, if
I'm doing
my maths right.
It does seem like about 70 years, but it is only seven months.
And for how long has he been talking about this wall? It's been probably a couple of years already. And so far, considering that we've got this far and this is actually the first thing that's even slightly more concrete, it's not a great pace we're seeing over here. So things are going to be happening slowly. But I guess Donald Trump feels the pressure as well, that at some point after all that talk, something needs to happen. So this is one small step further. And when I'm looking at the remaining three years and some months, with this pace, the wall is not going to be there by the end of the first presidency season, 4 years for Donald Trump.
That being the case, Chris, the people who turned up to his rallies when he was running for president, still turning up to his rallies now, chanting, build that wall. When the wall isn't built, are they going to be angry with him, or will they just go wherever he deflects the anger? Because he won't take responsibility for anything that goes wrong himself. He never has in his entire life. It will be, if the wall doesn't get built, this will all be somebody else's fault. Are his supporters going to buy that?
Absolutely. And I think that will be probably the epitaph of the Trump presidency in the end, is that there'll be all this stuff that was, you know, tabled at a certain point and talked about and that he chanted from the pulpit. But ultimately, when it came down to it, he will say, oh, if only they'd let me do what I wanted to do, the country would be in a much better shape, we wouldn't have the illegal immigrants, we wouldn't have this problem. And he'll apply it to everything from the bill with regards to the so-called Muslim travel ban, in regards to healthcare, with all this stuff. This will be his epitaph to his presidency. And that is kind of the problem here, is that, you know, the reality that he's facing now is all that stuff that he talked about on the campaign trail. It was so naive of him as a politician, the idea that he would get into power and any of that stuff would ever be actionable, you know, and certainly not in the way that he was proposing, because the US has certain checks and balances. It has a set Congress, it has a Senate system, it has all these things to stop someone doing something wily like building a wall when he wants to do and so on. I think what's sad now is that, ultimately, this is going to give those voters who, of course, you know, many of them are feeling very disgruntled by Trump at the moment. I mean, the slide downwards of approval continues. And I think that's not going to be unchecked by this. But I do think that, you know, the sad thing of all this is that it does give him that fuel that when it all comes to the end of it, those hardline followers are all going to say, oh, if only he'd done what he wanted to do, we'd be in a much better place.
And I think it's all about, if I continue a bit, I think it's all about these announcements. As you mentioned, there is some kind of a pattern. And, you know, when he announced that transgender soldiers would not be allowed to serve, that was one way of trying to boost his popularity amongst those right-wing supporters he has. And likewise, now that we see his popularity plummeting even more, now he's coming up with this announcement that actually makes it look like he's actually doing something about things.
But Fernando, what do you think? Are we seeing a pattern here of, you know, him barking some grandiose instruction and people around him saying, yeah, sure, Mr. President, we'll get on that right away, absolutely, and then basically punting it into the long grass and hoping he sort of forgets about it?
No, absolutely. And, you know, as everyone mentioned, okay, his popularity is plummeting. I think the latest one has 37% disapproval from Americans. But in my opinion, that's still quite high in some ways, you know. So the core support is still there. And as you know, in American elections, sometimes only the core support can win an election.
Someone pointed out here on Monocle 24 earlier that there are two types of power. I remember that. And, well, as the US president, he has the official power. So when he actually tells that something needs to be done, that should happen. But then, like, you know, when it goes that one step further, it's also about respect. And it looks like many people who are one way or another working for President Trump in this case don't have that respect and feel like there is no rush to actually make those things happen. And the situation could well be very different if they actually had more respect to the president to think that he actually is doing the right things.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. More shortly.
The Big Interview, the show that brings you the fascinating life stories of some of the most influential people in the world of art and culture, business and politics, is back. And we kick off season 6 in conversation with Massimo Bottura.
As a kid, I know that the best part of the lasagna is the crunchy part. The rest is for adults to eat and get fat. But the crunchy part is just emotion, pure emotions.
The legendary chef behind three Michelin star Osteria Franciscana joins me, Tom Edwards, in an enthusiastic discussion on all things good, food, art and beauty. But don't be fooled, Bottura is a man of big dreams, and between running his world-class restaurant, maintaining his hefty record collection, and making cameo appearances on Master of None, he also finds time to devote to fixing some of the world's big challenges, like managing food waste and feeding the hungry.
So this is what a chef in 2017 is an agent of change. You know, we are breaking the walls in the moment people are building walls and say, you are welcome. Come inside, have fun, have joy. Let's celebrate together.
Find out what other projects Massimo Bottura is cooking up on The Big Interview, premiering this Sunday at 9 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Marcos Hippie. Chris Lord has now left us and been ably replaced, I'm sure, by Henry Ree Sheridan, the producer of today's episode. Let us now welcome our new robot overlords in the specific shape of something called Lowry, a robot that sews. A sobot, if you will. Inevitably, it does this much faster, more efficiently and cheaply than a human seamster. And in another exciting harbinger of where the world appears to be heading, a Chinese garment manufacturer, Tianyuan, intends to open a vast sobot plant in the United States, specifically in Little Rock, Arkansas. Henry, seeing as how you've just arrived and I'm doubtless bursting with opinions about textile manufacturing robots, it will be, as it now is, at least as good as any human garment manufacturer. It will obviously get better as the technology gets better. Is this basically a good thing? With apologies to any of our listeners who may actually make garments for a living.
I think it's probably a good thing for garments, objectively. Whether or not it's a good thing for human society is another question. And I'm incredibly interested in automation and its effect on our economy. I think at the beginning of this century, various philosophers, economists predicted that by the time we reached about this point, the way things were going with the technological innovation that was going on then, most people would be out of a job. And I think their vision for how we would spend our time would be by cultivating our faculties and engaging in various edifying activities. As we all now know, that didn't happen. In terms of, obviously the great fear is that robots take away jobs and what do we then do with the human time and energy which is left over? I'm not sure if humans have demonstrated historically an ability to spend that time and energy in a very constructive way.
Well, Marcus, is this just going to be what has always happened? Technology has always put people out of work. Every technological advance ever made has put a certain amount of people out of work, and yet human society and human ingenuity tends to adapt to it. Automatic tellers were going to sort of render bank tellers unnecessary, and yet they still exist.
I guess humans are quite innovative. There's always new ideas and inspiration and new things to do if you have spare time. I'm just thinking that sometimes, when these things happen, then you just have to find new things to do. This is not quite connected to Asian textile industries, but just a funny story from my home country, Finland. I was just reading about that. People send less post nowadays because we have email and all that, no need for postcards and all that. And the Finnish Post has now decided to make their employees do new things instead of just dealing with mail. They are cutting grass, for example, if you ask them to, and also they can take care of the elderly. I think, it sounds quite amusing, but actually there's a good point to that. So you just have to think about how to use these people more wisely. And also I'm thinking about these people who may initially find themselves being made unemployed, redundant, if these robots that actually seem to be quite fast, supposedly one robot can do things 17 times faster than a person,
and they
without coffee breaks nor lunches.
Obviously they will get faster and faster.
So when these people are not finding jobs, I bet, there is always something else they can think about. And also, someone needs to be building these robots, for example, as well. There is always something, let's remember that.
May I say something bad about those robots?
Please.
I care about my garments.
They're robots. They're not going to hurt. You're not going to hurt their feelings.
Yeah, no, you know, for someone, you know, I care about my garments. You know, I do love t-shirts. I buy it from the brand, actually, which is made in England. And to be honest, those are plus points for me, you know. Like, I know it's made quality. It's soft. You know, it adapts to my body beautifully. I haven't seen any proof yet that the robots can do it. And I'm very skeptical because there are a lot of cheap, bad quality t-shirts around. Show me the robots should show me what can they do with that.
And that's,
sorry, I felt a bit emotional.
And that's also a value of having something actually handmade instead of robots. I actually really, really believe that these robots are not going to take over because people still want to buy things that have been made by other people with some thoughts and hopefully some passion. I bet there is going to be a lot of cheap t-shirts coming to the market at some point made by these robots. But at the same time, people who actually think about where things come from, care about that and want to buy something that has been made to last, I don't think this kind of robot technology works together with that.
But I mean, if you look back historically, right, like, I don't necessarily think that, like, how important is the hand of the maker in the creation of products? So, like, with the industrialization of agriculture, right, like, there's less of a human touch in agriculture now, but food is cheaper and better. And there's more variety of it.
Is it better? I need to question that aspect, though. Is it really better than before?
It is better. The crops we're growing yield more. It tastes better. We have more variety. The question is, in people's minds, how much of a percentage of people are going to actually care about the qualities that you're describing, which I'm not denying, but, you know, fashion now has surely reached a point, a scale of economy, where it's more similar to onions.
Having said that, I have to draw some comparisons to food industry over here, because you raised that topic. And even here in London, if you walk around and you see, you know, what kind of new shops are popping up, they are organic. And I don't think, like, you know, where that food comes from, I don't think they're taking a lot of pride if there's been robots working over there. It's mostly people who actually do these things.
The other interesting aspect, in fact, possibly the most interesting aspect of this, I thought, was that when the cost of labour is removed from this, and I'll put this to you, Henry, when the cost of labour is removed from the manufacturing process, a Chinese company would rather do business in the United States. Now, what does that tell us about the value of sound institutions and a transparent legal system? And is this something that's going to disrupt China more than it disrupts America?
I mean, listen, like, when in countries that don't have a manufacturing base, or the manufacturing base has been decimated in the post-war era, their economies haven't fallen apart precisely because their value to the world economy is embodied in the strength of their institutions, their ability to enforce abstract principles, rule of law. And America is, in spite of all of the kind of doomsday predictions that have been going on recently, a relatively stable country. The question is whether or not automation will advantage countries with, for example, stable rule of law, established court system, high-tech manufacturing capabilities, and also a very well-educated population. I mean, it stands to reason that it will. Those things tend to go together. And that would be a very interesting kink in history if things kind of U-turned in that way at this juncture. But we'll have to wait and see.
OK, well, we're going to move on slightly now to the cinema. And it has been a lousy summer for American cinemas, with revenues down more than 12% on last year. Now, that means, of course, that it's actually been a pretty good summer for the clearly dwindling numbers of cinema goers, who have had to put up with fewer other people, spoiling everything by rustling crisp packets and neglecting to switch their phones off. Fernando, I'm going to put to you a hypothesis here about declining cinema attendance, which is that people have basically realised, especially with the myriad other options now available, that cinemas are terrible.
I disagree. Okay. And I'll tell you why. Because I think the main problem of Hollywood and the box office this year is not because people don't like cinema. In fact, it's been proven wrong, because only last year was quite a successful year in terms of the box office. I think this year there was a problem of lack of creativity of the script writers in Hollywood.
So you're blaming the films rather than the cinemas?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people will agree with me, because there's been too many sequels. I know we've been saying this. I have nothing against a good sequel, but, you know, we didn't need a fifth Pirates of the Caribbean.
Sure we needed the first four.
Or the new Transformers, indeed, you know. And there's been two problems. The sequels performed terribly because people are not interested anymore. And when you try to be original, the original films were terrible. Like Luc Besson, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, which cost $200 million. But it was a terrible script, terrible acting. Nobody wanted to see that.
Is it not a factor that people are thinking, I want to go out on a Saturday night and I want to experience, or I want to experience audiovisual entertainment on a Saturday night? I think I can go to a theatre, which I have to, or a cinema, I have to pay money to get in. I'll be charged, you know, £15,000 for a bucket of popcorn, and then I will have to sit in a room full of incredibly irritating people who won't switch their phones off and who will rustle crisp packets. Whereas if I just stay home in my nice house, there's something really good on Netflix and I don't even have to go out.
I love going to the cinema, you know, for me. I think it's a pleasure. So because we had some successes this year, like for example Wonder Woman. So I say, you know, people are interested, they just want to see the right film. I actually think TV is and other forms of entertainment are just a complement. Like, you know, TV is a complement to radio. It's not going to, you know, TV did never killed radio, for example.
Thea, sorry, Marcus, do you want to go first?
You go first.
I wonder, Thea, do you think that you were talking about the quality of the scripts having diminished? Mm-hmm. And a lot has been said about the fact that lots of Hollywood scriptwriters who would have gone into Hollywood, some of the main creative talent, have been siphoned off into working for various streaming services. Do you think there's a connection there?
Absolutely. You know, they have big budgets. They are like what, you know, studios used to be in the past, in a way. So, of course, TV is capturing some of the talent from cinema. But, you know, I still believe, I think it was almost like a coincidental that this year, for some reason, there was a collection of terrible films around. And things can change in this fall because we have the new Star Wars. We have quite very
there's
strong films coming
new
up.
Star Wars? Oh,
there is another one.
God.
The Last Jedi, apparently. Jedi.
I'd just like to make a couple of points. I can now reveal that I haven't actually owned a television for quite a few years. Because
are you familiar with the joke, Marcus, about how you can tell when someone doesn't own a television?
I haven't heard that before.
They'll tell you.
That's the first time, actually. When I was doing TV in Finland, I got bored of seeing my own face on TV basically all the time. So that's why. Anyway, I haven't had one for 7 years. And I've fallen in love with cinema again. When I go there, it's the big screen over there. And, you know, I feel like I haven't numbed myself with that feed of moving images in a corner of my flat all the time. So I feel like it's got a greater power over me. I feel it's quite an emotional thing for me to go to the cinema to pay £20 for popcorn and just see a film.
I find that emotional as well.
Exactly.
I'm not sure if it's the kind of emotion and, that you're
and, at. And another thing, by the way, I had to mention is that, Andrew, you mentioned Netflix. And, you know, I still haven't got it. I still don't even know how it works, but I notice that when I see my friends, they're all talking about Twin Peaks, that's presumably on Netflix, and Game of Thrones. And I'm very surprised by how much attention these two TV series have got. And I'm also wondering if that is somehow reflected on popularity of cinema.
Yeah, I've never seen either of those series either. I also haven't been to the movies this decade, I don't think. So just finally on this, I'm going to ask the three of you for like one summer cinema recommendation, something you've seen this summer that you thought was really good.
The only thing I've seen this summer was Tom of Finland film, which I just saw a couple of nights ago. It's about this Finnish artist who was...
Called Tom, presumably.
Tom, who was from Finland drawing images.
They were up all night working on that title, weren't they?
Can I be a bit offbeat, of course?
Please.
We're not in art house season, so I did like one of the few successes this year, which was Girls Trip, a rom-com with an all-black female, actually, cast. I laughed a lot. It was quite X-rated at times, and I enjoyed it so much.
And the only film that I've seen this summer was, I think the big critical blockbuster of the summer, Dunkirk. Mm. And I have to say, I'm kind of in concert with you, Andrew, when it comes to the... I find going to the cinema socially irritating, even at the best of times. But I have to say, of all the films I could have gone to see, that one did make use of the scale of cinema just as a sensorial experience, I think, better than any other I could have seen.
So Dunkirk is actually that good, because it is the kind of thing I would go to the cinema to see if I went to the cinema to go to... Went to the cinema... To, you know what I'm saying.
If you were to go to the cinema to see something, yeah.
I wonder if you would have a film recommendation for us.
What, from this year?
Anytime.
I can't...
What was the last film you did go to see in cinema, Andrew?
I can't remember. I really, really can't.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. It was a long, long time ago.
I won't press you on it.
Absolutely no idea. It would be extremely dull radio for me to sit here for the next 5 minutes trying to remember.
We have some
last, last film I actually went to see at the cinema. No, I got absolutely nothing. We should move along. Finally tonight, it is that time of year at which many of our listeners are or have been on holiday. For most of the centuries that human beings have been taking holidays, it has been to get away from work. In the last couple of decades, however, it has become increasingly possible for work to follow you, and I suppose vice versa, and nobody seems to have quite figured out the etiquette. Well, earlier Ben Page, the chief executive of market research company Ipsos Mori, pointed out some cultural differences when it comes to responding to work emails while off duty.
Actually, the British and the Germans are quite good at switching off. So 6 out of 10 people in Britain say that they never look at the messages. In Japan and China, I mean, it's only a small minority who are not actually responding to emails all the time they're on holiday. And obviously, even they don't go on holiday that much.
See, for the second topic in a row, I don't really have anything because, much like going to the cinema, I don't really understand why people go on holidays either. Fernando, when you holiday, are you on duty at all?
I am, actually. So I have a little rule, of course, you know, I don't check the whole day. But when I wake up, I check the important emails. And if necessary, I forward to someone, because especially here in Monaco, we're all, you know, colleagues. So I know, for example, if Henry's here, he might help me out. I hope so, Henry.
You don't just write back saying, I'm on holiday, call someone who cares.
No, I don't do that. I don't do that. And you know, and if it's a boring PR, which we have plenty of those, I just don't reply.
We are listening.
I just don't reply and that's it.
Marcus?
I do. I've learned by all these years, through all these years, that I don't want to return to work having 2,500 emails in my inbox. So I kind of glance.
Will they all
them
be from people
through.
Who've seen you on TV in Finland?
They're mostly from boring PRs.
Yeah. Oops. I love some PRs. I have to say that. Sorry.
Yeah. A big shout out to any PRs who are listening to this program. I think you guys will be getting fewer emails from them in future, if that was your plan all along.
Hopefully,
Henry. What about you? Do you go on holiday and sort of respond promptly to work emails?
So I've tried both approaches. I've been on holiday and you've been very anxious about responding to every email that comes my way, and I've also managed on occasion to completely switch off. And one thing that I've observed is that when I do choose not to respond, nothing happens. And I wonder if the anxiety about needing to or feeling that you should respond to emails when you're away is actually at root a deeper existential fear of redundancy.
It's absolutely exactly because that. It's people realising, hang on, I'm not needed. I'm unimportant.
Very unimportant. And you realise that, you know, even within your company, if you didn't exist, almost certainly everything would just tick on the same.
It is. I mean, I understand Fernando's approach. I'm not a complete anti-holiday. The closest I get is I go to Australia at the end of every year for 3 or 4 weeks or so, and I do that thing. I get up in the morning, I deal with anything that's got to be dealt with, and if you're in Australia, basically while you're awake, everybody else is asleep, so then you've pretty much got the day free, and I find that is actually less stressful than, you know, taking a deliberate policy not to deal with work stuff. But Marcus, do you think it is that? Do you think people do have a need to feel like they're important, and that being connected on holiday has allowed people to be, I guess, you know, to tap into that and to continue to indulge it?
I think it depends on the country and expectations. I've seen two very different work cultures. When I was in Finland, we were given cheap Nokia mobile phones with email, and then basically the expectation was that when you go home in the evening, you switch that thing off and leave it in your cupboard. Likewise, when you go on a holiday, you leave your mobile phone home and fly somewhere for your summer holiday, which lasts for a month. So it's not an expectation over here, whereas I think, you know, in cultures and in countries such as, I guess, you know, London has very long work days. People are, I take the tube in the morning, I see everyone glancing through emails. It's a bit of more in the direction of general expectations of going through emails. And I think that kind of leads into the thinking that you have to show some signs that you are still somehow connecting to your workplace, even if you're on holidays. I don't know. I guess sometimes I'm wondering what would happen if I just didn't look at my emails for a few days. I haven't actually done that for 6 years.
It depends on your field. I mean, let's remember, we're all journalists here. So I think it's you know, things can happen out of nowhere when you're on holiday. Like here, you know, at Monaco, I cover a lot of stories about Brazil. You know, I would feel very anxious if something terrible happens in Brazil and I'm on holiday and they might need me. But, you know,
we
sorry,
can always
I'm on holiday.
Call you.
Please call me. I'm available to talk, even if I'm on the beach sometime.
That is, of course, unless you are a boring PR, interesting ones are still welcome to contact Fernando and Marcus. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Marcus Hippie, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Henry Rees Sheridan, and Chris Lord. Thanks all for joining me. Today's show was produced by Henry Rees Sheridan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jonathan Whitfield. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next at 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. Everybody's getting two mentions tonight. And I'll be back. There's another one for me with more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. I'm Andrew Muller. I make that me three, everybody else two. Thanks for listening.